Hello and welcome to the History Show on Near 90 FM. My name is Carl Brennan, and on today's show we'll be discussing local government in Dublin and its history. I'm very pleased to be joined today by John Dorney, historian and author, who co-runs the IrishStory.com website. I'm also joined by Kieran Wallace, who's a postdoctoral fellow in Trinity College Dublin, and Rona McCord, who's a postgraduate student in Trinity College Dublin also. Hello and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Cole.
Now, I'd just like to start off by asking John about some of the history of Dublin Corporation, and maybe you could deal with the brief history and then move on to maybe the 19th century history of the corporation.
Yeah, Dublin Corporation's history is actually a lot more interesting than you might imagine. It goes back to the Middle Ages, really, the history of Dublin Corporation. And in the Middle Ages, Dublin was a city of usually less than 10,000 people. And it was, as a medieval city, it was kind of cut off from the surrounding countryside by the fact that it did have a charter, that it did have a corporation, which meant that nobody had to pay feudal dues, nobody had to do what the lords in the countryside told them to do, which is a big deal. It was run more or less self-governed for most of the Middle Ages by aldermen who were elected by the property owners in the city, but also the freemen of the city, who were members of guilds. A guild is a bit like a trade union, but it also includes someone who has their own shop, a tradesman. And the guild, unlike a trade union, or in theory anyway, is a closed shop. If your father's a carpenter, you have to be a carpenter. And although the city changed a lot after the Middle Ages, especially after the 17th century, when the population started more or less doubling every 50 years or more, the structure of government, of local government in the city, was the same from the Middle Ages up until roughly 1840, when it got totally reformed.
So how did things move on then as the history of Dublin evolved? Say when we're getting into the post-Williamite period, where Catholics are being excluded from being able to hold public office and being able to vote, how does that affect politics and Dublin Corporation?
Well, the history of Dublin, if you like the religious or the sectarian history of Dublin, is kind of interesting, because Dublin obviously in the Middle Ages was an English city, it was a pale city, and they would have contrasted themselves with the Irish enemy, which is what they called them outside in the mountains, Wicklow and so forth. The interesting thing is, not just in Dublin but in the Pale as a whole, those people become Irish, if you like, after the Reformation, because they're Catholics, which is a big change. So Dublin is like becoming an Irish Catholic city, if you like, in the first half of the 17th century. What's unusual is that after the mid-century and the expulsion of Catholics actually from the city by the Cromwellian government, it became a Protestant city and was a Protestant city for about 100 years. And after the Williamite War, which was a demonstration because the Catholic Protestants took the city back, Catholics were banned from holding office in 1692. They were banned from being freemen of the city in 1692 as well. And the freemen of the city, the guilds, and the mayor became a Protestant stronghold again up until the 1840s. And the story of how the Catholics managed to sort of get a foothold back is an interesting story in itself.
Well, could you tell us about that? Because I think there was a local government act in 1840. So how did that change the political makeup of Dublin City?
The way I look at this is, there's two ways of looking at it. First of all, you can look at it as the Catholics getting back into power, but that's a very narrow way to look at it, because the other interesting thing that's going on is it's moving from a medieval, or if you like, a feudal way of looking at things, where everything is hereditary, where if your father's a freeman, you're a freeman, if your father's a vote, you're a vote, you have a vote, to a system where if you pay taxes, you have a vote, which is a pretty modern concept, no matter who you are, regardless of religion. And that's what happens in 1840, I think. The Local Government Act is proposed by a guy called Thomas Drummond, who was the Liberal Under Secretary for Ireland. It was actually a forgotten man in Irish history, but a great reformer. Yep. in terms of non-sectarianism. And Kieran, would you like to say something about Thomas Drummond?
I think Drummond is he's the guy who has on his statue in City Hall, saying property has its duties as well as its rights. And there's very egalitarian for that period, when like, having property was nearly like this sacred thing where nobody could take your property from you. But he said, if you own property, well, you had a responsibility to kind of spread the wealth, or to use it wisely, and to sort of help your fellow man. So a very good kind of, I thought, quite a modern thinker, but I totally agree, a bit of a forgotten guy in Irish history.
But in terms of Dublin, like I said, Dublin had been a Protestant city, and it was conscious of itself as a Protestant city for most of the 18th century. But by about 1800, because of the migration to the city, the Protestants lost their majority. And by 1800, they're actually about a third of the population of the city. But the working class Protestants, the artisans, who mostly lived in places like the Coombe and the Liberties in the west of the city, the west of the old city, they had, unlike the other working class people, they had a say in the local government, because many of them were freemen and they were guild members. But they lost that privilege with the reform of the corporation. And many of them were very unhappy. They felt betrayed pretty much by the Liberal government, and they felt betrayed by the fact that the Conservative government, which followed them, didn't actually repeal any of this. So whereas before, even though they'd been poor, they had a say in government, that was no longer true, and they were very upset about that. And one of the practical consequences of that is the 1840s. We not remember the famine, which did affect Dublin quite a lot, but also there was a big economic recession in the early 1840s. So poor Protestants before could have more or less looked after each other because they had access to privilege, access to power. They didn't have that anymore because Catholics immediately were a 2-to-1 a majority in the electors of the corporation. And what you see among middle-class Protestants is they tend to move out of the city to their own townships. We might talk about that later, in places like Rathmines and Monkstown and so forth, Kingstown, now Dunleary. But working-class Protestants, one of the things I've done before was I looked at this organisation called the Dublin Protestant Operative Association, which was a militant Protestant unionist working-class organisation in the 1840s, led by an evangelical preacher called Tresham Gregg. And they would hold meetings and they would denounce Catholic emancipation. They denounced the Corporation Act. They'd complain that the true faith, that Protestantism was being superseded by papacy, by fallacy and so forth. But really what they were concerned about was Protestants were on the ground who didn't have the wealth to insulate themselves from this, were losing out. And throughout the 1840s, quite a turbulent time in Dublin because of that.
Well, didn't you also have the rise of Daniel O'Connell and the repeal movement and problems that would have been seen from a loyalist background of Catholic emancipation and Catholics able to hold office then from 1829?
Sure. I mean, of course, that's in a way the main story. Because of the Corporation Act, Catholics are in majority. And while Dublin isn't Belfast, it isn't really harsh sectarian boundaries. At the same time, immediately when Catholics become the majority, Daniel O'Connell becomes the mayor, you know. And the Dublin Corporation in 1843 passed a resolution in favour of repeal, which was something that really galvanised the repeal campaign. And you had massive rallies in Dublin. The one in Clontarf, as everyone knows, was called off. But there was also, the tradesmen had a massive rally which marched from Cabra down to Donnybrook, and basically the repealers took over the city for the day. So from this period onwards, really, Dublin is a national city, if you like.
When you look at the history of Dublin and you see a lot of those icons are still left, a lot of those memorials to Dublin as a unionist city, you had the big statue of William of Orange there at College Green. But when you were doing your research, even well into the 20th century, do you still see a vestige of that old working class Protestant Dublin still there?
Well, not really, no. I think not so much working class. I think the Protestantism that is there is very much a throwback to that when the Parliament was there in Dublin, and even the Georgian buildings and groups who preserve the Georgian buildings, they do represent a different class, if you like. Because really, there was an influx of very poor people into Dublin as those people drifted out, at the same time. So there was a kind of a change in the makeup of the class makeup of the population. And they took over those buildings where once better off people lived in, and they became what we know as the slums.
Especially if you look at places like Mountjoy Square and Henrietta Street, would have been the great Georgian buildings of that period, the great townhouses of the aristocracy within maybe 100 years, probably less, after the Act of Union, they suddenly become slum tenements.
Yeah, they deteriorate very, very rapidly. I think Henrietta Street is one of the greatest examples of how a glorious street deteriorated really, really quickly. It was one of the most overcrowded areas of Dublin then, by maybe 50 years or less, probably.
And Kieran, how did this affect Dublin Corporation and its ability to finance itself when you're losing the rates of so many wealthy citizens of Dublin and they're moving out to the suburbs, moving out to the countryside? What effect did that have on Dublin Corporation?
Well, that had a huge effect. As John was saying, the middle-class Protestants and middle-class Catholics moved out to the suburbs and built their nice new handsome villas in Ballsbridge and Pembroke, and indeed Clontarf and some other areas, but mainly on the south side, and they paid their expensive rates on their houses. We're talking about bringing in new home taxes now at 100 quid residence tax. That's all because a very complicated set of rates was demolished in the 1970s, but that rate system that was there had a huge effect on your local council. So Dublin City found itself more or less between the canals, with sort of decaying, crumbling houses, as Rona said, that lasted for decades. Very little room to build new houses. So if you had a slum area or a tenement area and you had to clear it, you couldn't just put the people on the side of the road, you had to put them somewhere else while you rebuilt their area, and there was nowhere spare, in very little spare land inside the city centre, and they were constantly trying to take over the suburb, tried to take over Clontarf and Drumcondra. They eventually, by 1900, they did manage to take over with a big sort of parliamentary inquiry. They managed to take over Clontarf, Drumcondra and Kilmainham. They were absorbed into the city, but Rathmines and Pembroke, which is now kind of Ballsbridge, Donnybrook, Blackrock and Dunleary, Kingstown, they stayed outside until many years later. But they kept their money out, so they might be, you might be living in Rathmines and running a factory in the city centre, but your factory would be paying rates, low rates, because it's in a dishevelled area, but your house with its expensive rates would all go to Rathmines town hall or Pembroke town hall.
Just one of the things when you'd be reading through local history in Dublin, you see so many different terms for local government. Could you explain some of those terms, Ciarán, like poor law guardians and grand juries? What did all those mean?
I saw somebody describe it as local government in Ireland was like a Frankenstein's monster. It was a thrown together hodgepodge of medieval things and early modern things. So the oldest thing is the grand juries. The grand juries would have been, you hear it in America, like a grand jury is an actual kind of like a state court, but a grand jury in Ireland or England comes from, it was a bit like an early version of a county council. They were responsible for roads, bridges, courthouses and prisons or some combination like that. So a very specific list of things, and local landowners paid money to the grand jury, and then they would, the jury would meet, once every 2 months, and people would come with things called presentments, basically with appeals saying, my local bridge is breaking down, can you fund it again? And so they'd meet and they'd have to go through maybe 100 applications for funding, and they'd have to decide, right, these are the 50 ones we're going to fund. And the constant accusation there was, if you were on the grand jury, the road outside your house and the bridge outside your property was in good nick, but every other road was in terrible state. But the grand juries survived into when you got sort of town councils and city councils, so kind of the two things ran in parallel. But the poor law guardians, they were kind of like a local version of the Department of Social Welfare, I suppose is how you'd call it. It's like a county council version of social welfare or a town council. They came in the 1850s, the poor law guardians, Dublin had I think four sets of guardians, and a set of guardians, to confuse it even more, was called a poor law union. So you'd have, say, North Dublin Poor Law Union, South Dublin Poor Law Union, and they'd have maybe 20 or 30 guardians who ran the union. Interesting enough, that's when a lot of women first began getting involved in local politics, was through the union. They became guardians in the unions a lot earlier than they were councillors on town councils. So you had poor law grand juries building bridges and things. You had poor law guardians from the middle of the 19th century running workhouses, in extreme cases giving outdoor relief. So basically, if things were so bad and there was a long unemployment or a long drought or something, they'd actually give money to people without putting them in the workhouse. But all the time in the background, as John was saying, the sort of town council, the city council, the corporation was getting bigger and more important and gathering powers to itself, until by the end of the century, I think really 90% of all the local power was sort of attracted into the city halls and town councils. They kind of became the dominant force.
Well, Rona, one of the things that seems to be a constant theme, whether you're looking at the 19th century or the 20th century, is the issue of rates, and especially the class composition of the councils. Any type of social spending or social progress seems to have always been held up by the fact that the ratepayers don't want to pay this much taxation, they don't want to pay this much rates. How much was rates an issue at that stage?
It was a very big issue, and it's one of the... You know, the whole reason behind the council not being able to, or the corporation not being able to invest or to do anything about slum clearance or housing had to do, or at least they said it had to do, with there not being the financial wherewithal provided by central government or because of the rates. Like, so it was a huge issue, but they make it perhaps a bigger issue than, you know, they were responsible as well. They did abdicate certain responsibilities themselves in terms of housing conditions, in terms of investigation into the conditions of housing and condemning housing. And they let a lot of people away with it. And a lot of members of the corporation owned tenements or had an interest in tenements. And the structure itself was kind of difficult because people owned shares rather than owned outrightly a whole building. So a number of people would own a building, so it was very difficult to pin a responsibility on any one person. So it was kind of convenient for the corporation to blame the rates and the lack of finance. At the same time, they were correct that there was a lack, but there was also a lack of political interest on their part as well.
Well, to get back to the political side, John, some of the work you were doing in your articles, about the political makeup during the 19th century. As you said before, like Dublin was in Belfast, one of the things you were saying was there was a rotation of the mayoral train in Dublin that was unimaginable at the same time in Belfast or somewhere like this. Why do you think that the National Sound, the majority, wanted that rotation?
Well, I think because mainly of Daniel O'Connell, as far as I can see, and Daniel O'Connell is a lot more enlightened than people think he is now. He's got the reputation now as sort of like, you know, blinkered Catholic nationalist, which I suppose in one way he was, but in many ways he wasn't. He was very well educated and he was quite enlightened in many other ways. But and also O'Connell was a good politician. I mean, he didn't want confrontation. He liked to kind of work around confrontation when he could. And because most of the ratepayers, again, it comes back to the money. Many of the ratepayers were Protestants. He wanted concessions. He wanted everyone to get along because he needed to pay for the city. So when O'Connell became mayor, he made a deal where every second mayor would be Protestant or every second mayor would be Catholic. It would be rotated between them. And this deal stayed until the 1880s, I believe. So it was a way of sort of diffusing sectarian tension in Dublin. And that's one reason why you don't see, you know, Belfast-like violence in Dublin.
Well, people always make the point that the chain of office for the mayor of Dublin has William of Orange and the chain of office for Belfast has Éireann Cabhrá. So do you think we've forgotten to a large extent that loyalist history of Dublin?
Yeah, I do. I mean, but I think there's a good reason for that, and that's the fact that that sort of loyalism really faded very fast in Dublin. Like, the stuff that I was looking at was in the 1840s, which was a very turbulent decade. I mean, Daniel O'Connell almost forced repeal through massive agitation. People were afraid also of insurrection by the Young Ireland movement towards the end of that decade in 1848. And that was a lot more serious than people think it is now. I mean, it's disparagingly called the Battle of the Cabbage Patch or something. You know, but actually, like, if you look at the newspapers at the time, the unionist newspapers are really afraid. There's weapons coming in. They know there is. There's clubs which are stockpiling weapons.
It's just in the wake of the famine.
And it's in the wake of the famine. Actually, the famine is really still going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, the unionists are talking about arming themselves. I mean, this is a pretty serious crisis. I mean, the fact that it didn't happen now means we think, you know, it wasn't important. But my point is that at that time, you do see this militant unionist working class thing where they say we're going to have to fight. We're going to have to fight for the union and the Protestant religion. And in the later 18th or 19th century in Dublin, although there is, what's the name of the organisation, Kieran?
The City and County of Dublin Conservative Working Men's Association.
That's the one. The Conservative Club actually is still there in York Street, I think. You know, you do see that, which is more or less a Dublin working class unionist organisation. And you do see the odd stone throwing with home rulers in the 1880s. You don't see talk about we're going to have to fight or we're going to have to get weapons. And for some reason, which I don't think anyone is really clear about yet, that just fades away. You don't see that militant loyalism as it comes into the 20th century in Dublin. And as far as I'm aware, in the political conflict in the 20s, when the guns are obviously being used, in Dublin, I don't see any sign that they've been used in a sectarian way. So maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that there is.
Well, when you were doing your research on them, did you find that they were very much a working class organisation looking to themselves and their own power, or they were appealing to the Protestant aristocracy to look after their interests?
A bit of both, because they're very conservative in the sense that in the early 19th century sense, which means that they believe in the aristocracy and they believe in their power to order society. And there's lots of people getting up at their meetings and saying the poor Protestant has been abandoned by his fellow Protestant who's richer, and says, but the aristocracy, the Protestant aristocracy, they're going to regret this. You know, they're going to regret this when they have to fight against the Irish rebels and the Catholics and the Papists and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, it didn't come to that, but it might have.
So when you're looking at, you know, a map of Dublin in that period, we're talking about like towards the end of the 19th century. How much is Dublin expanding or how much is it stagnating?
It's, well, I think the actual Dublin region, or the greater Dublin, if you like, is definitely expanding. But Dublin city proper, like the bit the corporations is responsible for, is expanding in numbers, but it's caught inside the canals. So it's becoming like a hothouse, and it's getting, like, as we're all saying, all the housing situation, the state of the streets. But if you look out into the suburbs, they're building more buildings, they're laying down new tram tracks, they're making more new roads, and they're spreading further out. If you talk up to the early 20th century, yeah, definitely it's the only part of the country, in fact, the only part of the country that's expanding in population. All other counties show a reduction across the late 19th century, but Dublin's population is the only one that increases. Mm-hmm. Now, that increase is presumed because of inward migration. People come from rural areas to live in Dublin, And that's part of the problem, because when you come in to live in the city, you don't have deep pockets, you don't have deep roots and family network. So you're going to rent a room somewhere or rent a part of a room off someone. And if there's a very transient population coming in, some of them may be emigrating, but that really adds to the accommodation problem. I think this kind of inflow of transient people with no roots in the city, and their needs are greater. They don't have sisters that can put them up for the week, or they don't have mammy's house they can go back to with their new kids. They're basically just in living in greater and greater squalor because the city can't take them. But the suburbs are spreading out nicely.
They also add to the unemployment problem in the city as well, which was regularly over 20%. And you had a situation where people really couldn't fight for more wages because it constantly had an influx of people from the country coming in. So, you know, you could sack a worker and get another worker very quickly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one question for both of you two that I've always had about Dublin is that this idea of constant migration to the city from the country, what did that do to create the culture of Dublin that we know it today, do you think?
That's interesting. Well, you know, they say, what's the definition of a culture? Is a Dublin man's father. It's not true in my case, but
guilty over here.
But I think it gives Dublin kind of a funny position in the national memory. I sort of think there's a bit of a thing in Irish history that Dublin doesn't fit, and they're kind of uncomfortable with Dublin. Like Irish history, even since the rebellion, is like, we had the rebellion in Dublin, but before that we didn't really like it, and after it we kind of didn't really respect it because it was kind of decaying. So I think how the Irish history looks at Dublin is kind of funny, because it was an Irish city, it was then, you know, Protestant controlled, and then for a brief while it had a kind of a Catholic rise, but it became poor, which wasn't fashionable, and then after that it was this sort of constant influx of people who felt, well, my parents are from Longford, I haven't been living in Dublin, but I identify with Longford, like, you know, who do I support in a match, type of thing, and maybe it takes a generation or two to sort of put down roots and believe yourself to be a Dubliner. So I think, but that's the truth. I think a lot of cities have a very changing, fluid kind of identity for a long time. Maybe in the 20th century it kind of solidified a bit more into its own sense of Dublinness. What do you think, Ron?
Well, I think there may have been a very strong sense of Dublin for a short period, for a couple of generations. But then you had everybody moved out to suburbs. Mm. So you were no longer a Dub. You were from Cullester or one of the suburbs. So I think, you know, for maybe two generations there was probably a much more stronger identity of being a Dubliner.
Well, it's also the question as well that during that early 19th century period and late 18th century period, you had the idea of Dublin as the second city of empire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that something that people in Dublin at the time were very proud of, that connection with the empire and the imperial parliament in London and having their own parliament as well and being a major player in the British Empire?
I think so. I think I've heard the argument put that there's this thing, sort of second city-itis type of thing, a second city syndrome. Now, Dublin wasn't the only city that claimed to be second city, so like Liverpool, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Birmingham, all at different times claimed to be second city, depending on trade or population or exports, mm-hmm. whatever way you measure it. But Dublin certainly had a claim to it. But it is a thing that they were aware of. One example of second city-itis that is portrayed is, if you look at some of the squares in Dublin, are a lot bigger than the Georgian squares are a lot bigger than the squares in London. And with this notion of, well, if this handsome idea of building squares with railings in the middle and nice red brick houses, if that's big in London, and if their squares are 100 yards by 100 yards, ours will be 300 yards by 300 yards, just to show that we're not this provincial backwater. And they say even the front square in Trinity College, if you go to Oxford and Cambridge, the squares are much, much smaller. Mm. But the Trinity had to say, we're not these backwoodsmen, we can build a huge square. But as an example of second city of empire thing, I came across a funny story where Queen Victoria's, one of her children was getting married, and there was a royal sort of celebration, and all the cities were allowed to send delegations to this thing, and you got announced into the royal presence as, you know, the Lord Mayor of London, the Lord Mayor of Bath, the Lord Mayor of whatever, and Edinburgh was ushered in ahead of Dublin, and this caused ructions because Dublin felt it outranked Edinburgh. And so there was a huge big debate and who loved the Queen more, and this is in the 1860s, so this is during this rotation of mayors times. And so they had to hold a bit of an inquiry into it, and the Queen cleverly didn't decide who she loved most. She let them sort it out amongst themselves. So then at the next sort of Great Levee or something, Dublin was ushered in ahead of Edinburgh, and then Edinburgh complained. And Edinburgh finally ended up producing a book showing its claim to having to outranking Dublin in the order of royalness of the city. And Dublin said, oh no, we were a royal capital more recently than you were royal. We were a royal capital up to 1800, but Edinburgh ceased to be a royal capital in 1707. So this odd thing of claiming that status, which we couldn't imagine today, but at the time it was really important to him.
Well, eventually Queen Victoria did have a bit of a falling out with Dublin Corporation over a failure to send the best wishes. Does that show the sort of divisions in Dublin Corporation at the time between the royalists and the non-royalists?
Oh, I think if you wanted to get a hot debate going in Dublin Corporation, just turn up with a royal visitor and you'd have mayhem immediately all the time. I think it was a big... I mean, certainly when Victoria came in 1900, continuous meetings, one saying we will give a royal welcome, the next meeting saying overturning that and so forth. And then when Edward VII came, same story for the first, he visited a few times. And then when George V came, constant, like, you'd have a mob would gather outside to protest against the royal wedding, a crowd would gather outside to protest against the royal welcome. When Victoria was coming, they lined up a welcome saying, you know, you're welcome, Your Majesty, to your ancient and loyal capital of Dublin. But then after all the hoo-ha and the fighting over it, they reworded it to say, we condemn the articles of the Act of Union, which was brought in through corruption and malice aforethought, and we will never be happy and free until we have our own parliament back in Dublin. And now you're welcome to Dublin, Your Majesty. So they totally changed the whole tenor of the thing. But the royal connection was very fraught all the time. It was a good measure of political sensitivities.
But I suppose if somebody was looking at Dublin at that period and the welcome that was given to Queen Victoria, would they be right in saying there was an air of loyalism still in Dublin, or was this just like Italia 90 or just a day out?
I think there's a difference. I think it's a grand day out, and sure, if you got a day off school and you're a kid and there's flags and bunting and horses, wouldn't you go out and stand and see who the celebrity was? So there is a kind of celebrity thing. But I do think there was a difference between loyal to the empire and all that sort of thing, and the sort of the sense of UK-ness. And loyalty to the crown, I think it was an affection, an Irish affection for the crown, which could still live hand in hand with being a, you know, traditional green, even Gaelic nationalist Irish person wanted home rule, and an affection for the crown. I think those two things were there, and it made what they call like advanced nationalists very uncomfortable. They didn't like public displays of royalty because it could be portrayed as loyalty, and I think royalty and loyalty aren't always exactly the same thing.
We're just going to take a break now for a minute or two, and we'll be back in the second half to continue this discussion. And we're back. Now, Ciara, I'd like to start again by asking you about the 1898 Local Government Act. What was the rationale behind bringing that in, and what effects did that have on local government in Dublin?
This sounds like the most boring thing in the world, the Local Government Ireland 1898 Act, but it's been the centre of my life for about 3 years. So, yeah. But actually, it was really important. The powers and the responsibilities that local government was getting all through the 19th century, they just couldn't cope. I mean, they hadn't got the city corporation was getting more and more things to do, but it hadn't got the fundraising capacity, it hadn't got the machinery of government to make it happen. So the 1898 Act was meant to sort of clarify all those lines, you know, take powers away from the poor law, take powers away from the grand juries and give it all to the corporation so that the corporation could behave like a modern government. But the key thing that it did was it changed from being like a vote based on having money to a vote based on having very little money, much more equal, not one man, one vote, and that's as much as they could hope for. But in fact, there was one ratepayer, one vote, but a very low rate. So even women at that stage were getting local government votes, which is a big breakthrough. The amount of voters in Dublin went up 400% overnight for the local government. So that was a huge change. If you were a local politician in 1896, you knew who you were going to ask for a vote. You'd go and you'd knock on the door and you'd say, "Hiya, Jimmy, can you give us a vote?" 1899, it was a case of you just couldn't get around all these people. And people living in one-room flats and people who are labourers and people who are women, God forbid, had votes. And, you know, so this notion of, how do you campaign to these people? It's amazing, actually. 20%, I've calculated about 20% of the voters were women. And only one candidate in 1899, when this new body of voters came along, only one candidate actually addressed women as voters and said, "I appeal to the women to vote to me on the following basis." The others just thought, "Oh, you know, will they know how to do it? Will the women know?" They had a separate polling booth set up for them, so they even had their own polling booth, like it was a women's polling booth alongside a men's polling booth. And then the newspaper said things like, "The women stepped out bravely and took their part in public life by making an X on a paper." But anyway, but the 1898 Act expanded the powers hugely, and was the real kind of, if 1840 sort of politically empowered the majority to sort of get involved, 1898 gave them the mechanism to actually use that power to great effect. And I think I mean, it was at that point that you could really say you had a kind of a cradle-to-grave relationship with your town council. We think the corporation is something kind of distant now. It kind of doesn't even collect your bins anymore. But the corporation then was hugely important. Milk that you'd get for kids, you know, the quality of milk was governed by the corporation. Playgrounds were built by the corporation. Housing was provided by the corporation. Schooling, if you went on the Mitcham School, it was a corporation person who came to get you. Your local hospital beds were funded by the corporation. When the old age pension came in 1909, that was handled by the corporation. So the corporation, and they ran the graveyards as well. So literally the corporation ran a very intimate connection with voters. And that was all based on the 1898 Act. And they got the power to collect much more taxes, or taxes from greater number of people. So it transformed things completely, and councillors now are real politicians. They've really something to do.
Well, I was going to ask, John, this Local Government Act in 1898, it was part of a wider scheme called Killing Home Rule with Kindness. What was the idea behind that? Or was it, as Ciarán says?
Well, the traditional historical account will tell you that it was part of a package by the Conservative government, including land reform, the Windham Act, which enabled farmers to buy their land. And local government was part of that, introducing greater democracy, which in Ireland meant giving nationalists real power for the first time, albeit at local level. Ciarán, I don't know if that's, you go along with that, don't you?
Yeah, no, I sorry, that's fair enough. Yeah, just like, was it Killing Home Rule with Kindness, or was it trying to make the union work? So different sides of the same coin. Yeah.
I mean, of course, we can say now that it, again, another historical thing, it didn't work because nationalists only got more strident or more powerful. Yeah. But who knows? It might have worked.
But I think that the idea being that if you remove a lot of the grievances that people have about living under the union, that to be happier with the situation that they have at the moment under the United Kingdom, that if they had a degree of local say in how things were run, they had a greater degree of political representation, Republicans and separatists would have less hold on the public consciousness. But did this work, or did it create a breeding ground for nationalist politicians to get their first taste of real power?
Well, it did obviously give nationalist politicians their first taste. I mean, there's lots of people like W.T. Cosgrave is the best example, who was the only Sinn Féiner for a long time on Dublin Corporation, but he cut his teeth there, and he was obviously the first Prime Minister, although they didn't call it that, of the Free State. President, it was called. I think, though, thinking about that time and thinking about the whole thing of Killing Home Rule with Kindness, is that it was was part of democratisation that was going on in Britain. I mean, although obviously we have had Irish nationalists had their grievances with Britain. Britain is one of the most liberal countries in Europe in the end of the 19th century, one of the most democratic. But I do think that it was sort of a fundamental misconception on the part of the British that, you know, nationalism would be killed because nationalists were treated better, because nationalism is about power, really. And the more power you give nationalists, the more powerful they get. That might seem like a simple thing, but it's true. And I think the same is true in Scotland now. Not that I'm against Scottish independence, but if I was against Scottish independence, I would give them less power. I would concentrate all power in Westminster, because nationalism is not really, in my opinion, about like material grievances. It's about power.
So when you were looking through your research, Rona, did you notice that more and more people are now looking to the corporation as a body that can get things done on their behalf? Do people start to have more faith in the corporation in this period?
I didn't really find any evidence of that, really, you know, to have to say. I mean, I'm looking specifically at working class people, and I understand the points you make that they're on the ground, they are involved in their lives, but I don't think they make a big connection between themselves being political or themselves as voters.
Or that it could be something that they could influence.
Yeah, I don't think they do see that, really, like.
Well, if we look at that period, Ciarán, if we look at the political makeup of local government in Dublin at the time, there's almost an expectation that Labour and working class candidates would have done a lot better. Like, you have people like James Connolly standing for election and not getting elected. The old Irish Parliamentary Party still seems to have that stranglehold on the Catholic nationalist vote.
Yeah, there's. It's depending on your politics. It's nearly pitiful to see how like really good, strong Labour candidates are going out, and then the only way they can get elected is by reciting this kind of nationalist mantra at the election stump, And then, so they were going out looking for sort of Labour votes and campaigning on Labour grounds. But they have to say, yes, we want Home Rule. Yes, we want a Catholic university. Yes, we want to release political prisoners. And they have to go through this kind of green agenda before they get down to the Labour stuff. Mm. And there's maybe half a dozen of them have very little funds trying to get elected. And then you got the Irish Party coming out with big funds, lots of people, lots of experience. And they're saying, we're the working man's friend and we'll solve the problem of the working man. Just wait till Home Rule. It'll all be all right. Rally around behind us, folks. And they kind of gobble up the Labour movement. But in 1899, with the first reformed election, there's like nine, it depends on how you describe somebody as Labour, but nine people you could call Labour are elected onto the city council, and there's 60 members. So that's a good showing. But that number then trickles down as some of them kind of get sucked into the IPP, the Irish Parliamentary Party. What happens then is a more radical version starts to come out about 1905 onwards, which leads towards it's the likes of Connolly trying to get in, and leads towards Larkin and people like Partridge and Lord and others who are less well known. But they come out sort of realising that you have to stand firmly aside from the Irish Parliamentary Party and say, talk about purely Labour things. But they're a small, sort of tightly formed radical Labour group at that stage.
But I think even then, though, Larkin has to compromise as well, because he doesn't want to form an Irish union. He wants, you know, people to be part of a trade union movement that's, you know, the trade unions were British, and he didn't want to change that.
Yeah.
But, you know, he came to the conclusion that he had to. People were very reluctant to join a British-based trade union, so he had to form the Irish Transport and General Workers Union.
From a nationalist awareness point of view, he couldn't get around it. Yeah.
One thing which struck me, I was reading Porrick Yates' recent book about Dublin in the First World War, we've got the Labour tradition emerging, we've got, you know, radical nationalism, but they also have the really old tradition of the Irish independent chancer emerging, a guy called Alfie Byrne, for example. Yeah. apparently, I don't know if this is true, but apparently Alfie Byrne wanted to be a councillor because he wanted the rates reduced for his pub or something like that, you know. I don't know if, does anyone know anything more about...
Well, as a general point, if you look at all the occupations of people on the town council, on the city council from 1900, and this is the thing I was doing, trying to see, well, who were these people who said they can get elected? Mm. And you can go through the census records and sort of measure them all out. And it's always been shopkeepers and publicans. Grocer publicans are always the most common occupation on the town council, followed by professionals, probably lawyers and accountants and doctors. And then quickly, in the next sort of third biggest group, is people involved in property, both buying, selling and letting property. So you think, well, nothing changes.
Thank
really
God
all
that's
that.
Gone.
But just, yeah, exactly. But the notion of a publican wanting, like you say, you joined local government either for what it was, in other words, what you could do to help your fellow man, or for what it did, in other words, your pub licence, or if you're a builder, could it give you planning permission to build a row of new houses? And but then in fairness, you have the likes of Cosgrave, who came from a family, they were publicans on Thomas Street, but he always had an eye to like the working class of Dublin and the impoverished, in fact the non-working class of Dublin, if you like. Cosgrave seems to be one of these, again, somebody, I know there's a big biography due out on him in a year or two's time, but he's again overlooked, and his kind of council career is overlooked, I think.
When we're looking at the occupations and the type of people who served on local government in Dublin, Rona, I think when we look into some of the issues regarding housing, we see that a lot of these people had their own property interests, as Kieran was saying, and that might have been one of the reasons why they were so reluctant to condemn properties or to investigate bad landlords.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there was three, the famous cases, the three O'Reilly, Corrigan and Crozier, who owned 61 between them, or shares in 61 houses, and they were all in very poor condition, and I think most of them had been condemned but were never closed down. Like, so you had a huge vested interest, but you also had a situation where before 1908, where they brought in the Clancy Act, the council had to compensate any landlords if they removed the houses, basically. Like, so if you went in and said, "We're condemned this house, knock it down," you had to compensate them up until that point, where that they became responsible themselves for it. Like, so you would have been paying the corporation would have been paying the money to a landlord who was probably on the corporation for taking down a condemned building. Like, so there was a lot of vested interest there, definitely.
But just to put that in context, I mean, Dublin, the vested interests are getting in the way of a really serious problem. I mean, Dublin has the worst slums in Europe, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the worst in the UK, and it's, in some of the literature will tell you that it was the worst in Europe, or in very close to conditions in Calcutta in some cases, people would say. But yeah, it was a very bad situation, with overcrowding, with infant mortality, cases of tuberculosis. yeah, there was quite a bad problem, like, and that's why you had houses collapsing as well. And this was the part of the issue as well, where you had people, you know, the corporation was supposed to be investigating these bad areas or bad housing, and they weren't really enforcing any legislation against people, because obviously, as we've said, there's vested interest groups going on, like, so, you know, they didn't do the work they were supposed to do, so things got worse and worse and worse, basically.
Well, this you must
until you had
it.
You had buildings collapse, basically. You had
yeah,
Thomas Street,
and, famously, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There was a number of them up to then, before that, which the 1913 Church Street one is the more famous one. What happened there was you had a building that was on a corner, which had incidentally been condemned and should have been closed down or removed, that fell down and it dragged the second house down beside it, and 12 people I think were killed that night. And then you had an inquiry after that. It had been building up the inquiry on the way, but the inquiry itself is kind of a political issue. It's not as straightforward as it seems, because the inquiry was not held by the corporation, and it was held by people who were pretty much anti Dublin Corporation and anti the nationalist members of Dublin Corporation.
But this must have led to huge scepticism about the corporation and the type of people who were serving on it by the wider Dublin public. Maybe in the same way we view politicians at the moment, you know, that people would have had very little confidence in city councillors.
You don't really get a lot of that opinion. You get the opinion of people who, if you look at the makeup of people who go on to these inquiries, they're not the ordinary people. A lot of them actually probably weren't even Irish. It was an inquiry that was a royal inquiry, so it was set up by the king, and you have people who would be very middle class and not necessarily even resident in that area of Dublin. They may have been from the outer areas.
But, I mean, in regards to what people's opinion of local authority was, I mean, certainly when the new generation, the Sinn Féin generation, gets their hands on power in the 20s, they do tend to have this attitude of local government is all about corruption and people looking after each other. And that's why we might get onto this, but that's why they abolish much of its power when Ireland gets self-government in the 1920s.
One of the things I found was really interesting when I was looking into this period, something that I didn't know, was that Dublin was far closer to what London is now when we look at it, like loads of separate local councils running their own areas.
Absolutely.
Rather than one large council running a large area. And the amount of different areas in Dublin that had their own autonomous council, maybe you could talk about that, please.
Yeah, I mean, this is, go back to the idea of people moving out to the suburbs in the middle of the 19th century, but by 1900, by 1899, if you look at a map of Dublin, it was this patchwork. So Clontarf was its own self-governing township. They had a rented town hall, but if you'd vote for local councillors, you'd pay your tax locally to Clontarf, similarly Drumcondra, similarly Kilmainham. But the best example, or the most obvious example people would see, would be Rathmines. If you go into Rathmines now and you see the big tall red brick clock going down into Rathmines on your left as you go out of town, that was Rathmines Town Hall, and built in about 1902, but that was a huge kind of symbol of Rathmines independence. And Rathmines felt very different to Dublin, and so would Pembroke, which is like Ball's Bridge, so would Clontarf, felt very different. And people would choose where to live because the tax rate was different in different places. Even the tram speed limit was different. So you had the tram companies complaining going through Kingstown, that it was the lowest speed limit in the kingdom. And they said, so they had to go different paces, going through different, so like you're crossing over these invisible boundaries. And but the thing became nearly unworkable, and the city corporation was well aware of this. They would constantly point to the patchwork as being a reason they couldn't fulfil their duties. And Ron would say, yeah, they didn't do what they're meant to do. One of the defences they'd say would be, we hadn't got the money. The other was, well, if they did a great job in policing, say, drains all around the, say, Portobello area, well, they might make everything very nice and disease-free there, but somebody might have bad drains just across the canal in Rathmines, and that might infect their drain. So how do you police it if there's a kind of a paper line drawn on a map, and disease or bad milk isn't a respecter of those sort of things?
Well, I was just wondering, were these local councils, were they completely autonomous, or were they under an overall Dublin County Council? Did they have any relationship to the corporation?
No, they're completely autonomous. The only overarching thing was the local government board, which was like a national department of environment, effectively. The town councils, Rathmines and Pembroke and Clontarf and so forth, they had representation on the county council, Dublin County Council,
But that was just, they'd send a couple of members up to those meetings once a month, but they really were busy running their own stuff. The corporation was completely separate, and their independence actually was part of the problem. They were always sparking off against each other on different, you know, Rathmines built its own drainage system because it didn't want to share its sewerage with Dublin sewerage, that kind of level of separation, you know. But no, they were fiercely independent, I'd say. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is interesting, that concept of, you know, now we'd have like, you know, I'm from Coolock, I'm not from Balldoyle. Mm. But yeah, there you had definite council boundaries to reinforce that. But as well, with these different councils, what type of political representation was on them? How did they differ politically from one region to the other?
They basically, Clontarf was unionist as long as it lived. The Ardilons, the Guinnesses, who had St. Anne's Park and all that stuff, that was all them. Drumcondra, which is a townland, township of its own, was kind of white collar Catholic, kind of respectable nationalists. All those red brick terraces built for kind of the clerocracy. Kilmainham was interesting. Kilmainham was kind of people involved in industry and the coachworks and the railway yards out there. A good number of kind of Scottish and English descendants and people who were sort of Presbyterian, Methodist, mm-hmm. and dissenter, those kind of, and that gave them kind of a good strong trade union kind of background. And then Rathmines, very strong unionist. Pembroke, relatively strong unionist, like union majority, but some nationalists there as well. In Rathmines and in Pembroke, you had middle class Catholics living there who were doctors and lawyers and all, and they were voting unionist as well. Factory owners, office owners, they mm-hmm. voted unionist mm-hmm. at the same time. You don't often think of Catholics who would be, maybe they were nationalist in theory, but they were voting unionist for the local town council because they thought these are the best guys for keeping the rates down mm-hmm. and making sure the streets are cleaned. And then Blackrock was union. Blackrock was 50-50. Kingstown was mainly unionist. Dunleary, yeah.
So that's interesting, that concept of, you know, it seems to happen in other cities in Britain, and at that same period that a city might send somebody to Westminster and have like a very strong vote for them, but at local government, a whole different issues could come into play.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's always the way in local politics. Like, you know, the cliche, all politics is local. Well, local mm-hmm. politics is really, really local, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I suspect that you're going to get things which we would never see looking back being important. I mean, things like the equivalent of potholes in the road now, or whatever the equivalent was in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
So he may be a unionist and an orange man, but he keeps the rates down.
I mean, you know, apparently people voted for Paisley, for Ian Paisley in the North for precisely these kind of reasons. Yep. You know, mm-hmm. Catholics did. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's not inconceivable, you know.
Yeah. Also as well, like, I think when you were talking there about Kilmainham, that seemed to be one of the, I won't say radical strongholds, but one of the more diverse councils in Dublin in terms of political makeup. One of the areas where, like, Labour and Sinn Féin would have got a foothold.
Yeah, absolutely. It was absorbed into the city in about 1900 with 1901 with the Dublin 1900 Boundaries Act. But when it was absorbed in, it became like a ward within the city, the overall city council, and it tended to always have, like, every ward had four representatives, and there was always going to be some kind of radical Labour or radical, Sinn Féin being kind of radical reformists at the time. And just a word on Sinn Féin, we tend to think of Sinn Féin as this kind of nationalist, separatist, Gaelic Irish Ireland kind of party. But it's funny, when you look at other cities in Britain and in North America, they were all concerned about corruption on their town councils, and everybody gave out what the town council didn't do what it was meant to do. So reform movements grew up, usually called the Reform Party or the Reformers or the Ratepayers Party, grew up in every city. In Dublin, I believe that Reform Party was Sinn Féin, because they operated only municipally for the first number of years, and they came in, they were young, they were zealous, they were teetotal, they were white collar, and that's exactly the profile of Reform Parties in Boston and in Birmingham. Behave very differently in different cities, but that notion of our city is corrupt, we're going to get in there, we're the young dogs, we're going to sort them out, mm-hmm. and then from there use it as a springboard to national politics.
Rona, how did you find, like, different political parties' attitude was to housing and social conditions in Dublin? Did some people just play lip service to it, or were there some other candidates or parties who really had definitive ideas about what they wanted the local authorities to do about the problem?
The only person that I had come across at the beginning of the 20th century who emphasised the housing problem was Larkin in The Irish Worker. And he, you know, he built up a huge campaign really about it, because he understood that the conditions that people were living in were so appalling. Like, then he connected it to their wages, and he connected it to, you know, union membership and he campaigned for a long time. And he did put forward ideas and solutions about building. He actually put forward the idea, which eventually was taken up by Cosgrave in the 20s, of building outside of the city, of taking over some suburban green belts and building on virgin soil. Other groups really didn't put forward. You had smaller groups of philanthropic groups who put forward ideas and tried to build houses, and you had people like Guinness who built housing for their workers, and the Western Railway Company. But really what was happening was they were building sort of ad hoc, and there was no planning involved, and so it was bad for the city, really. It wasn't really until 1924, when Cosgrave started to look at building up Marino, that he actually had the idea of planning for working class houses in particular.
Now, if we could look at another issue, John, perhaps the issue of policing a city like Dublin, mm-hmm. and you have the Dublin Metropolitan Police, yeah. as opposed to the Royal Irish Constabulary for the other 31 counties. Mm-hmm. What was the relationship between policing and local government, and how did that relationship change as compared to, say, a similar city in Britain?
Yeah, well, the big difference between the DMP and, say, the London Metropolitan Police is that in not only in London, but in every big city in Britain and England, it's run by the council or the corporation. And in Dublin, the DMP is run by Dublin Castle. It's run by effectively at a remove by the British government, which shows you why Ireland is different in the United Kingdom and why Irish history is different. But one of the interesting things about the DMP is that up to the 1830s, they had the first go at creating police force in Ireland in the 1830s, and it was pretty much, it was quite sectarian. It had the reputation certainly for being quite sectarian, quite Protestant dominated. And one of the things which Thomas Drummond, I'm again going back to him, did was to start recruiting Catholics for the police. And one of the things that ultra-Protestants, as they called themselves again in the 1840s, going back that far, were complaining about was that Papists were being recruited for the police, and soon the police would be all Papist and so forth. But the DMP was, the advantages of the DMP was it was relatively non-sectarian, although the officers did tend to be Protestants for most of the British period. It was unarmed, again, unlike police in Britain, but unlike the rest of the police in Ireland, the ORC, who were quite well-armed. And it was fairly honest. You know, I mean, we take this for granted now, but I mean, the fact that many police forces in many parts of the world are not honest in a really straightforward way, mm-hmm. as in they offer to kill you if you don't pay them, or they do the organised crime themselves. And that was true in the 19th century and it's true today in many parts of the world. And the DMP were in more or less an honest police force. But as regards politics, if you go back to the 1898 Act, which introduced local government, I mean, the Dublin Corporation was viewed by nationalists, by the IPP, as sort of an embryo of what an independent Irish Parliament might look like. But what's really missing is control over the police. And where this becomes an issue is in things like the lockout in 1913, when there's obviously a lot of violence. And actually the ORC were also drafted in. But the Nationalist Party don't really, I get the impression Rona might know more about this, but the Nationalist Party don't really know what to do about this big labour dispute. It's sort of outside their experience. But there's a lot of complaints about how the DMP acts. I mean, they do beat to death two or three people and they injure many, many more, hundreds more. And it exposes the fact that they're not under democratic control, that they're under the control of Dublin Castle. So it does expose this kind of contradiction in British rule, that in one sense they're trying to be more democratic, but really it's not in the final analysis.
Well, I think if we can move on again to another issue, Dermot Ferriter had that series on the limits of liberty, and one of the themes he dealt with was the centralising power of the Irish state post-independence, that after you have the creation of the Free State, you see the Department of Local Government starts to abolish many county boroughs, city councils, and I think it was imagined that at the time that this would be a temporary arrangement, but Ferriter makes the point that this was part of a larger centralising of power in Dublin with the Dáil, rather than, for example, somewhere like England, where the local authorities have a lot of power, a lot of different services come in under their remits, and electing them actually has a big impact on your lives. Whereas now we don't really place the same emphasis on local government as maybe they did 100 years ago or more. What would you think about that, Ciarán?
The centralising argument, I mean, I think it certainly there is a trend, obviously, in the early Free State years towards centralising. But I wondered, and again, the thing that John mentioned earlier about sort of the motivation for sort of getting rid of local government and Sinn Féin thinking it was corrupt and so forth. I think Sinn Féiners must have had a view, or the new state sort of apparatus must have had a view that it had been corrupt. But I often suspect that they had used that during the revolutionary period, during the War of Independence, you had the underground Dáil, the Dáil on the Run, mm-hmm. and they had the Sinn Féin courts and these type of things going on. And at this time of extremists, they decide to set up with a government on the run, like a wannabe Irish state on the run. They set up a Department of Local Government, which always seems kind of a weird thing to do. You'd think they'd be setting up like just all about guns and money, but they set up a local government department on the run. And the reason is they get the local town councils and city councils around the country to swear allegiance to the new sort of emerging Irish state. And this is a very clever way of winning over hearts and minds. And they start diverting local taxes to the new Irish state as opposed to the existing British state. That was a very successful tactic, and I mean financially and emotionally very successful. I kind of wonder, maybe this is a bit fanciful, come independence, did they think, we're never going to let anyone do that to us, thanks very much, and they pulled the power out. We can see what a powerful sort of rock it could be against central power, so we'll take away this notion. So, I mean, it is part of a centralising thing, but it's to take away that layer of democracy to sort of ensure that everybody faces in the one direction.
Well, that was a very interesting discussion, and I'd just like to thank all the guests, John Dorney from the IrishStory.com website, Kieran Wallace and Rona McCord from Trinity College Dublin, and I'd just like to thank you, the listeners.